Rabbi Kelman is about to speak. Just for those of you who weren't here before, I'm going to tell you briefly just a little bit about Rabbi Kelman. Rabbi Kelman did his undergraduate studies at UCLA and did graduate studies at Harvard in Christian literature. Rabbi Kelman is a professional downhill skiing instructor, so if any of you that need lessons. After that, Rabbi Kelman went on to be the news director and anchorman for a California radio station, and then went to Israel to conduct 12 years of postgraduate field research, which included an exploration of 165 of the world's major religions. He is now a professor at the university in Texas as well as in Jerusalem. He has inspired thousands and thousands of people across the globe. And you're about to take part in this. It is my honor and privilege, again, to please introduce to you Rabbi Lawrence Kelman.
Okay. Love is. There's a passage in the Gemara, in Brachos, the Talmud, that the first time I saw it, I found a bit confusing. The passage talks about a time when the Romans had banned any observance of Judaism. And certain crimes were punishable by death. Specifically, it was forbidden to teach Torah in public. During this period, a great sage by the name of Rabbi Akiva went out into a public square, stood up on a block of wood, and started saying, "Come, come! Who wants to learn Torah? Come, come!" And the crowd started to gather. Some of them, perhaps, to learn Torah, probably most of them, to watch the gruesome scene that was about to entail. There was a secular Jew who was watching this whole horrible tale unfold, and feeling bad for this white-bearded sage, the secular Jew went up to Rabbi Akiva, and he said to him, "Rabbi, aren't you afraid of what they're going to do to you?" And Rabbi Akiva looked at this fellow who was standing next to him, and he said to him, "What can our situation be compared to? It's like a fox that's walking along the riverbank. And the fox sees some fish swimming in the river. And the fox whispers to the fish, 'Would you like to come up here with me and dwell with me up here on the shore like your ancestors dwelled with my ancestors?'" The fish look up at the fox and they say to him, "Are you the animal they call the cleverest of all animals? You're not clever, you're a fool. If here in the water, which is the place of our life, if here we're afraid, how much more so we should be terrified to go up there with you." A moment later, the Romans arrived. They pushed through the crowd. They saw Akiva, they walked up to him, they grabbed him, they bound him, they dragged him off. They put him into a Roman prison. And from his prison cell, he could hear outside the sound of the executioners building the execution platform. As sunset approached, Akiva heard the jailer door open the jail. Then he heard the sound of someone being dragged down the hallway. And they opened up Akiva's cell and they threw in none other than this secular Jew who had been standing next to Akiva. secular Jew looked at Akiva and he said, how fortunate are you? You're going to be killed for teaching Torah. I'm going to be killed just because I was standing next to you. A little while later, they came. It was just getting dark outside. They unlocked the jail door. They grabbed Akiva. They dragged him out. They lifted him up onto this torture platform. And they took out devices which could only be described as giant potato peelers. And they began from the bottom of his body and they slowly peeled the skin off of all of Akiva's body. And as they were killing the man through slow hemorrhaging, it suddenly became dark. And when it became dark, Akiva closed his eyes and he got ready to say the evening Shema. Thousands of his students had gathered to say goodbye to their Rebbe, and they were watching this scene. And one of the students cried out, Rebbe, Rebbe, what are you doing? What was bothering the student is, there's a Jewish law that under extraordinary circumstances, when concentration would be absolutely impossible, a Jew is not required to say the Shema. The Talmud tells a story of a person on their wedding night. Might be impossible for him to concentrate. In that sort of a circumstance, at least in olden days, a person was not required to say the Shema. Certainly, if they're peeling the skin off of your body, Rebbe, you must be potter, you must be excused, what are you doing? Rebbe Akiva opened his eyes and he looked at the student and he said, my whole life, I've been waiting to fulfill the verse. And you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. With all your soul means even if they take your soul. And now I'm not going to fulfill it. And Rabbi Akiva closed his eyes and he began to sing. Shema Yisrael. Elokeinu Shem Echad. And the Talmud says that Akiva's soul left him with the word Echad. It's a beautiful story, it's a dramatic story. It's an amazing chapter in Jewish history. But the more that you know about Jewish law, the less this story makes sense. For example, there's a Jewish law that says that if you are a teacher of the tradition, you're a carrier of this tradition, you're a rabbi, and you're keeping some religious observance, and one of your students sees what you're doing and says to you, Rebbe, what was that? Why did you just do that? So the halacha is, the teacher must confess, I was following a Jewish law. You cannot hide that you're following a Jewish law. Why? Because the whole Torah is an oral tradition. And if the teachers of that oral tradition try to hide that oral tradition from their students, then the Torah will be lost. So if you see your Rebbe doing something, you ask him, what are you doing? He has to quote you chapter and verse. That's the way the law works. Now we know that there are certain Torah commandments that it's better to die rather than violate. There are certain acts which are so degrading, it's better not to live through them. So for example, if someone puts a gun to my head and says, kill this person or die. It's better not to wake up on the other side of having killed somebody. Better to die. Rape this person or die. It's better not to wake up on the other side of that. Worship idols or die. Worshiping idols, something we're not familiar with today, is so degrading, it's better not to wake up on the other side of that. Most people know there are three cardinal sins. It's better to die rather than do. What most people don't realize is there's a fourth category. There's something else we have to die rather than do. And what is that? If the secular government, as part of a campaign to wipe Judaism off the planet, forbids any particular Jewish observance, even just a Jewish custom, even if it's not a Jewish law, just a Jewish custom, since that campaign is part of a larger campaign intended to wipe out all of Judaism, you have to die rather than cooperate with such a decree. If Jews normally wear black shoelaces, and the secular government says wear pink shoelaces, even though there's no Jewish law that Jews have to wear black shoelaces, but since this is part of an attempt to wipe out all of Judaism, and they're going after this particular Jewish custom, you have to die rather than put on the pink shoelaces. Now, with these two laws in mind, that if you catch your Rebbe following some halacha, he must confess chapter and verse. And when the secular government makes a decree that they're going to wipe out all of Torah, then you have to give up your life rather than violate any mitzvah in the Torah. Why is it that when Rebbe Akiva was up on the platform and the secular Jew said to him, Rebbe, what are you doing? Don't you know what they're going to do to you? Aren't you afraid? Why didn't Rebbe Akiva just quote chapter and verse? The secular government has made a decree. They're trying to wipe all of Judaism out. They've banned the study of Torah. Therefore, I have to die for this. Why didn't he just quote chapter and verse? And of course, the answer is that in that case, there was no law requiring Rebbe Akiva to do what he did. Why? Because he could have taught Torah in private. He could have taught in his house, in a local Beis Midrash. He could have gone to a shul. He didn't have to go up and make a show. And there's no halacha that if the secular government makes a decree against Judaism, you have to go out and commit suicide. The reason Rebbe Akiva couldn't quote chapter and verse was there was no Jewish law requiring him to do what he did. But if there was no Jewish law requiring Akiva to do what he did, and Akiva went out in public and started teaching Torah knowing he was going to die, that means Rabbi Akiva committed suicide. And what's more bizarre is in a religion that so cherishes life, no one ever in history has condemned Rabbi Akiva for what he did. In a religion that looks terribly on suicide, yet Rabbi Akiva was always praised, and this moment is held up as the triumph of his life. So what's going on here? To understand, we have to take a big step back. When God created the universe, what did he have in mind? What was his goal? So of course, we don't know very much about God, but the one thing that we know about him is God loves. God is full of love. He is by definition love. And therefore all he wants to do is do good and take care of. He created this whole world in order to give us the greatest gift possible. And of course, the greatest gift possible is not to make someone into a charity case. The greatest gift possible is to give every opportunity to every person to create their own eternity, on their own. So in order to do that, of course, what God has to do is he has to give every person an assignment, a job. And by fulfilling that job, you create the salary that you'll eat for eternity. And now when you get there, it's not charity. You earned it. It belongs to you. Now, how much does a God who's infinitely good want to give you? What kind of a salary does he want to have waiting for you there? So of course, if he's infinitely good, he wants to give you an infinitely large salary. Now, can he give you an infinitely large salary for any particular job? Well, imagine the following. I tell you, listen, I know that you've been having some financial problems recently, and I really would like to help you out. I don't want to give you any charity. I'd like to employ you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pay you £1 million a year. Yes, I'm speaking to you. £1 million a year. And What I'd like you to do for that £1 million, it's going to be salary. Don't worry, it's not charity. I'd like you to come to the JLE once a year when they have me here, and I'd like you to set up the podium for me. If you'll just set up the podium, you just have to move it right there into that position. If you just place it here, then I will pay you £1 million a year. Okay, now who's fooling whom? You know that's charity. I know that's charity. Everybody else knows that's charity. You don't deserve £1 million a year for setting up a podium once a year. If you want to get a job which really deserves £1 million a year, you have to become the chief financial officer of the largest hedge fund in London. You've got to work 26-hour days, get a heart attack and a divorce, and then you would deserve £1 million a year. Another way of saying that is, if you want to give somebody salary, not charity, the job you assign them has got to be worth whatever you want to pay them. How much does God want to pay you? This much! If God wants to pay you that much, your job must be worth that much. What job could be worth that much? If you ever want to know what the most important job in a company is, look and see what the boss is doing. If you want to see what the most important job in the entire universe is, look and see what the boss is doing. Well, the boss is loving and giving. So that must be the most important job in the whole world. And so every human being was assigned one essential responsibility: to become the quintessential ohev, the lover. We came to planet Earth to be a lover. That's why we're here. That's the purpose of our lives. That's the reason for the journey. That's why all the experiences took place, was to create in us the personality of the lover. The definition of love, of course, is elusive. Or perhaps I should say it's controversial, because it's really a cultural issue. We all came here to be lovers. But what is love varies from culture to culture. In the West, we can appropriately say, I love hot dogs. I love hamburgers. I love chips. I love Disneyland. Those are all appropriate uses of the word love. And when I say I love all those things, I mean the exact same thing as when I say I love my wife. In what way? Chips make me happy. So do hot dogs, and so does Disneyland, and so does my wife. When someone in the West says, I love, what they mean is, I'm having a great experience. I'm enjoying this. Me, I. Love is a completely selfish experience. There is a Hebrew translation of the word love, but it's not the word ahava. It is anochiut, selfishness. That is the Hebrew translation of the word love. So what is the translation of the word ahava? So just take a look at the way the word is structured. The root of the word ahava is hav, give. Ahav is first person future, I will give. Ahava is a state I go into where all I want to do is make her happy. I just want her to smile. I want her to have a good life. I want her to be fulfilled. Love is all about me. Ahava is all about you. It's the exact opposite, a completely different perspective. This whole world, according to the Torah, is about ahava. I will give. Now, if you're not falling off your chair at this point, it's only because you don't realize what the implications of this are. And I'll give you an example from a real life story. I was teaching at Neveh a few years ago, and there was a woman who had been down at the Kotel, and there was a rabbi there who often brings women, men who are hanging around the Kotel to yeshivas and seminaries. And he saw this woman standing there looking a little bit lost, and he walked up to her and he said, "Excuse me, ma'am, would you be interested in visiting an Orthodox Jewish women's seminary?" And this woman looked at him and said, "Tell me something, Rabbi. At your Orthodox Jewish women's seminary, are there other Orthodox rabbis?" And he said, "Yes, there are." And she said, "There are? Then I'd very much like to visit the seminary of yours." So he said, "Okay." Get in the car. He drove her to Neve Yerushalayim. He brought her into the building. Everyone else was teaching. I was the only one who was free. He's walking down the hall looking for someone for her to talk to. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. Brings her into my office and says, "Can you speak with her?" And I said, "Sure, come on in, have a seat." The woman sits down in front of me. And I said, "How can I help you?" And she says to me, "Are you an Orthodox rabbi?" So I said, "Good morning." I said, "How can I help you?" She said, "Tell me something." She said, "On Monday, I'm flying back to America. And I'm flying back on Monday because I'm scheduled to have an elective surgery to ensure that I will never have children. And as an Orthodox rabbi, I'd like to know, how do you feel about that?" So this was 9 o'clock in the morning. I said to her, "What do you think I'm going to say?" So she said, "I think you're going to say I shouldn't do it." So I said, "If I said what you think I'm going to say, what would you say?" I said, this poor lady, I'll never forget her face. Her eyes welled up. And she started to cry. And she said to me with quintessential sincerity from the bottom of her heart, she said, "What would I say? I would tell you that you're crazy. What's wrong with you people? Can't you hear the cries? Don't you feel their pain? This world doesn't have enough food. It doesn't have enough water. Certainly doesn't have enough love. And you want me to bring another child into this hellhole? What's wrong with you people?" And she broke down and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. So I thought for a few minutes. And I turned to her. And I said to her, "Imagine the following. You've just graduated elementary school. And you arrive in high school. Now, high school is a lot more exciting than elementary school. There's all sorts of different things that are going on. And your friends are taking a lot of elective classes. There's after-school activities. They're all getting involved in this stuff. But you have a dream. And every night, 5 o'clock, classes are over. You go home. You crack open those books and you study. An hour, hour and a half every single night. You finish off your freshman year, your first year in high school with a 4.0 grade point average, perfect A's, top grades. Comes the second year of high school. There's late night parties. Some people are starting to get their licenses. They can drive around their cars at night. There's after-school sports. People are getting involved in all sorts of different things, but you have a dream. Every night at 5 o'clock you come home and you study 2 hours, 2.5 hours. You finish off your sophomore year, your second year in high school. 4.0, perfect grades. The dream is sliding within reach. You start your junior year, the third year, the year that counts. You want to make sure you get good grades. Every night, 5 o'clock till 9 o'clock at night, you're cracking those books. You finish your first semester, 4.0. Second semester. Halfway through, they give you the student achievement tests. They're graded on a scale of 0 to 1600. You score 1590. You can see the dream sliding into reach. You finish your junior year, 4.0, you file your applications, middle of senior year. The letter arrives from Harvard University. You open it up. Congratulations. You've been accepted to Harvard undergrad. The dream is so close you can taste it. You head off to Harvard. The only problem is all the people at Harvard have been doing what you were doing for the last 4 years. The competition is insane. You're up till midnight, 1 o'clock, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning every single night. You finish off your first semester at Harvard, 3.8, you stumble. Second semester, you recover, 4.0. Second year, 4.0. Junior year, the year that counts, 4.0, perfect grades. You take the MCATs, the medical school examinations. You pin the needles on the MCATs. You file your application. Middle of your senior year, you get a letter. It's from Harvard's medical school. And you open it up and it says, congratulations. You've been accepted to Harvard's four-year med program. Welcome. Your dream is almost ready to begin. You show up at Harvard Med, and there the competition is unbelievable. There are people who are staying up 16 hours, 18 hours, 20 hours, 22 hours. At the student orientation, they tell you, one third of the incoming class will be dropped after the first year, another third after the second year. Heading into finals, you're not sleeping 2 days, 4 days, 6 days, 8 days, you're going straight. An hour of sleep here, an hour of sleep there, your hands are shaking. You walk into final exams, you take your final exam, you sleep for a week. They post the names of all the people who finished the first year and made it. The graduates, so to speak. You go down to that hall, and your eyes start scanning, looking for your name. And you realize, oh my goodness, I've been pursuing this thing for 8 long years. I'm at the end of my 9th year, and, oh, there's my name right there, I made it. Okay, fine. You go into your 2nd year. Crazy competition, all night, all day, studying. You make it. 3rd year, 4th year, internship, residency. It's been 16 long years. I can't believe it's been 16 long years. Look at this. I'm all suited up. I'm wearing the gloves I've got on the greens. I've been asked to take over as the chief physician of the Yale emergency room. I can't believe after 16 long years, now I'm going to fulfill my dream. And when you're finished suiting up, you walk out of the locker room and you're headed towards those double doors, the surgical theater. As you're headed towards those double doors, you suddenly see the doors open, and another physician walks out. He's got blood all over his arms, and he's crying, oh my God, it's a nightmare in there, it's a nightmare in there. And you walk up to him and say, what's going on in there? And he says, it's terrible, there's people with gunshot wounds, there's people with stab wounds, there's limbs hanging off, it's a nightmare. And you look at that man, and you say to him, my friend, that's not a nightmare. That's my dream. And you walk in there and you start healing people. I said to this woman, if you came to this world to take, then this world is indeed a nightmare. Because there's not enough water, and there's not enough food, and there's certainly not enough love. Everybody needs a shoulder to cry on.
But if he came here to give, this world is a dream. You were created to be a lover, an ohave, to give and to take care of. And you were sent to the right emergency room. There's no mistake. Everything is exactly as it should be. Because the Jewish definition of love is to give to and to take care of. It's all about her, not me. Now, if the Jewish definition of love and the secular definition of love are different, then it's got to come out that the Jewish definition of marriage and the secular definition of marriage are going to be different also. Because after all, marriage is that institution based on this concept of love. So in fact, if you open up an Oxford English Dictionary and you look up the word marriage, it's like the third definition there, is a merger of two or more corporate entities. And I believe that's truly Western marriage. A Western marriage is based on love. What do I enjoy? What's good for me? And I enjoy you, so I'm going to bring you on as a partner in my business. And as long as your division continues to make profits, then certainly I want to maintain this partnership. But if anywhere along the way it turns out that your division starts not producing enough to pay for itself, then why would I possibly want to maintain this partnership? We'll sell off that part of the business and we'll acquire something new. It makes a lot of sense, actually, why the divorce rate today in the West is hovering around 50%. What's amazing is it's not higher. Why are all those other people hanging out? I mean, after all, do you think that over 50 or 60 or 70 years of marriage, your partner's always going to carry their weight? You think they're always going to be psychologically okay? You think they're always going to be physically healthy? Of course not. There are periods in everyone's life where someone is low. There's periods of depression. There's periods of difficulty. There's periods of people not being healthy. They can't move. They can't walk. Why would you hang on to a person in such a state if you're involved in an arrangement called marriage? So I understand what's happening in the West. Now compare this great Western institution called marriage to the Jewish institution. There is no Hebrew translation for the word marriage. The Hebrew word for marriage, nisuin, is not in any way compatible. Nisuin literally means carryings. It's the plural of the word carry. I asked my Rebbe, why is the word for marriage called carryings? And he explained to me, Leib, when you go under the chuppah, you pick up your wife and you promise no matter how heavy she gets, you won't put her down. And of course, he meant that in a way far deeper than I probably understood it. A marriage is not a 50-50 deal. A marriage is a 100-100 deal. Or at least the nisuin is. That is, when I get married, I step underneath the chuppah and I promise that no matter what, I won't drop you. My Rebbe asked, what is the safety cable that holds marriages together during tough times? So one can easily answer what most people would answer. The safety cable is love. And of course, if you mean the secular definition of love, that's a joke. Because during the tough times, love flips into hatred. The opposite of love, by the way, is not hatred. Love and hatred are flip sides of the exact same coin. The opposite of love is going to be apathy. But the reality is when things get stressful, the love becomes hatred. That's normal. That's
That's a perfectly fine marriage. That's even the state that many people experience in Nisuin. It becomes hatred. It's very, very, very difficult. So what holds the marriage together? What's the safety cable you hang on to when the love becomes hatred? Maybe it's mutual understanding. Someone suggested to my Rebbe, mutual understanding holds together a marriage. My Rebbe laughed. He said, two men are so unique, each of them with such a unique profile, intellectually, spiritually, psychologically, two men could never fully understand each other. A man and a woman, he laughed, different species. Are you kidding? They're going to understand? Mutual understanding, that's no basis for a relationship. So what's the safety cable that holds together a marriage when everything is falling apart? One word, nisuin. Sometimes I would translate that as integrity. I promised. I promised I would stand by you. There's an amazing scene from the secular world. An amazing scene that took place a few years back. There was an actor in America by the name of Christopher Reeve who had a bad accident. They operated on him, and the doctors saw clearly during the operation this man was never going to move again. He was going to be a quadriplegic. When he was laying there, as he came out of the anesthetic from the surgery, the surgeon was standing on one side of him and his wife was standing on the other side of him. And the surgeon began to break the news to him. Mr. Reeves, I'm very sorry, but we don't believe you're ever going to move your body again. We think you're a quadriplegic. And Reeves was laying there, and he said to his wife, it's okay. And his wife said, what's okay? And he said, it's okay if you divorce me. She said to him, why would I divorce you? And he said, because I'm not Superman anymore. And she said, I didn't marry you because you were Superman. That is an example of what an ordinary Jewish marriage should look like. I didn't marry you because you were Superman. I married you because I was so full of love. I had such a need to give. I so badly want to take care of somebody else that I hooked up with you forever. For good or for better, I'm standing by you. That's Nisuin. Rev Dessler reveals a fascinating psychological principle about love and marriage. Rev Dessler says that every person contains within themselves a certain amount of ahava, a certain amount of love, but you can drive the level of ahava up by giving. The more that you give, the more that you love. Now let's define exactly what we mean by that. It's not called giving when I say to my wife, go ahead, you can take out my trash. That's not called giving. It's called giving when I let go of something that I really want. So when we're trying to decide what to have for dinner, and I want Mexican, and she wants Chinese, and I say, let's go for your Chinese food. That's called giving because I'm letting go of what I want. The more that I let go of what I want, the higher the levels of ahava rise inside of me. And the goal in life is to push the ahava up and up and up until it pops through the infinite levels that God feels towards us. Imagine the following. Woman sitting by the table, the kitchen. She's rubbing her temples. And her husband's standing there, says, sweetie, what's wrong?
And she says, "Oh gosh, I have a splitting headache."
Can you imagine this man waking up in the middle of his marriage and discovering that he doesn't have enough ava inside of himself to sacrifice and walk over and open up the cabinet and hand her the bottle of aspirin? Can you imagine the nightmare of waking up in the middle of a marriage and realizing I'm that empty? Okay, he's not. He walks over to the cabinet, he opens up the cabinet, he grabs the aspirin.
Oh.
It's empty. Can you imagine waking up in the middle of a marriage in realizing you don't have enough love to get into the car, drive down to the pharmacy and pick up another bottle of aspirin and bring it back for your wife? Okay, he does. He gets her the aspirin. And he does it day after day, week after week, until the doctors discover that she doesn't need aspirin. She needs a new kidney. Can you imagine waking up in the middle of a marriage and discovering you don't have enough love to say, "Oh yeah, don't worry, I'll give you mine. Come, let's go to the hospital, we'll do the surgery right now. Go ahead, let's go. But this gets a little bit frightening because I'm starting to ask, like, do I have enough love to have somebody cut open my side and take out my kidney? That's a lot of love. What happens if she doesn't need a kidney? What happens if it's a more serious situation? What happens if there's a child, and the child is his life is in danger, and he's behind this spinning wheel, and the only way for me to save his life is if I take my arm, and I stick it through that wheel? Do I have enough love to give up an arm? What happens if it's not just one arm? What happens if it's both legs? Do I have enough love to give up both legs? Do I love that much? What happens if it's not both legs? What happens if it's everything? Do I have enough love to give up everything? In 1981, I met a man who I fell immediately in love with. His name was Alex. Became my best friend. Alex and I met in a Jewish environment. I decided to go off to yeshiva. Alex decided to make Aliyah and go to Eretz Yisrael. Alex went to Eretz Yisrael because he wanted to fight to save Jewish lives. When he got to Israel, he didn't have time to make Aliyah, it was so fast. He made Aliyah at the airport. When he was making Aliyah at the airport, he said to them, "Can I join the army now too?" And they said to him, "You're crazy. You've got 3 months. Go away." The day after he arrived in Israel, he went to the Katzin Ha'ir, the army office in Jerusalem, and he tried to apply to get into the army. And they said to him, "You've got 3 months. What do you want to rush for?" And he said, "Take me now. I came here so I could fight and save Jewish lives." They looked over his medical report. They said, "You have asthma and flat feet. What are you doing here? Go away." He said, "I want to fight." They said, "We can't take you because you're crazy." Alex fought and fought and fought with the army until finally they let him into the army. He immediately enrolled in a commander's course. Fought his way up until he became the commander of his unit. As soon as he became the commander of his unit, he applied for a transfer to the paratroops. He was granted a transfer, went to the paratroops, immediately enrolled in a commander's course, worked his way up till he became the head of that unit, then immediately applied for a transfer to one of the crack troops that does the Entebbe type missions. When he received that transfer, he immediately enrolled in a commander's course, worked his way up to second in command of his unit. My best friend, my hero, Alex, used to agonize over whether when the time came he would do the right thing. He wrote the most beautiful poem. I have it at home. He was an artist. He drew beautiful pictures. He wrote this poem. from the commander's course. He wrote, if the war comes, when the war comes, I will have to have the calm courage to yell to my men or to whisper, Kadima, step forward. And I will have to have the calm courage to step forward myself. My best friend Alex was a great, great man because all he cared about was whether when the time came he'd have enough love to give up what had to be given up. In 1986, the Hezbollah was shooting Katyushas over into southern Israel. And they sent up Alex's unit to southern Lebanon, try to clean out the terrorists in the cliffs. There were three helicopters. First contained Alex's commander and a medic. Second had Alex, a medic, and a handful of paratroopers. And the third had the rest of the troop. The commander, under the cover of night, landed. He and the medic tried to find a place where they could create a secure encampment, and they were in regular radio contact with Alex for a few minutes, and then the radios went dead. And in that moment, Alex's dream was fulfilled. It was his 25th birthday, and Alex became the commander of one of the top units in Israel, at least for a few minutes until he found his commander. Alex instructed his helicopter to go down, then Alex went looking for his commander. And when he saw that his commander had been felled by terrorist bullets, he didn't know if he was dead or alive. Alex had to make the decision, should he leave things and come back tomorrow when he cleaned up in daylight, or should he run in now? And my friend Alex, at only 25 years old, was so full of love that he couldn't leave his commander behind. And knowing exactly what might happen, my friend Alex rushed into fire and fell to a terrorist bullet on a rocky hill in southern Lebanon. He was only 25 years old, but he was a very great man. He was a lover, and there was nothing that was outside of his repertoire. He could give everything. Let's go back one more time now and learn through the Rabbi Akiva story and see what we've learned. Akiva went out in public. And he said, come, come, let's learn Torah, which is the guide to how to be a lover. It's the guide to real Ahava. And a secular Jew walked up to Rabbi Akiva and he said, Rabbi, aren't you afraid? Don't you know what they're going to do to you? This might hurt. And Rabbi Akiva looked at this poor fellow. And he thought, how am I supposed to explain to you what I'm doing? You who think that life is about a fancy car and a comfortable retirement, a vacation home in the hills, how am I supposed to explain to you what I'm doing? So he told him a story about a fox that was walking along a riverbank. The water represents the Torah. And the fox said to the fish, the Jews who swim in the world of Torah, wouldn't you like to come up here with me? And you could live together with me like your ancestors lived together with my ancestors. You could be a Roman as well. You could work on Wall Street. You could have anything you want in this world. Why are you living this Torah lifestyle? And the fish, the Jews, said back to the fox, your culture, you think you're so clever? You people out there in the streets, you're fools! If here, in the world of love, if here it's difficult, how much more terrifying it is out there in the world of isolation and loneliness, of selfishness, where it's all about me, me, me. Where you can't get a job at the top hedge funds unless the owner of the hedge fund hears, all you want is money, money, money. That's the man I want for my hedge fund. You value family? Sorry, you're not for us. How much more terrifying is that sort of a world? The Romans came, they grabbed Akiva, they dragged him off. They put him up on this torture platform. And they began killing him, slowly. And as the sun set, Akiva prepared to say the Shema. His students cried out to him, Rebbe, what are you doing? And Rebbe Akiva said, don't you understand? My whole life, I've been trying to fill the verse. You should love with all your heart and with all your soul. I've been trying to push my levels of love higher and higher. I've gotten to the point where I can sacrifice almost everything, but there's one thing I've never been able to sacrifice. And now I'm not going to fulfill the verse. Imagine the following. I'm in 17th century Poland. I'm sitting in the kitchen with my cousin. Oh my goodness, there's a blizzard out there. It looks really cold. Hey, you see that? I go over to the kitchen window. I wipe some of the frost off the kitchen window. There's a man out there. He'll never survive. We've got to help him. I go to the front door. I open the front door. It's 5 feet of snow. I get a chair. I crawl up on the chair. I push my way out through the snow. I'm wading through the drifts towards this man. Tell you something about my wife. My wife is an artist. She's been an artist since she was a child. She's a natural artist. She loves to draw. Her favorite thing to draw is roses. But my wife's never seen a rose because we live in 17th century Poland. And as I'm running through these snowdrifts towards this crazy fellow, I see his hands are above his head and he's pushing his way through the snowdrifts, and I see something shiny up in his hands, and I call out to him, hey, what are you doing? And he calls back to me, I'm a flower salesman from Italy. I said, what do you got there? He says, a bunch of long stems. You want them? I said, how much you want them for? He says, they're going to cost you 5 pounds a stem. I said, wow, 5 pounds a stem. I might have that on me. Just a minute, please, yeah? As I'm peeling off the bills and giving him the 5 pounds, my cousin catches up with us. What are you guys doing out here? There's a blizzard. You could die. I said, well, this guy's got roses. My wife loves roses. He says, how much are they? I say, 5 pounds a stem. He says, that's ridiculous. I wouldn't pay that. As this whole scene is taking place, I turn to my cousin. He looks at me and he says, what are you paying so much for the roses? And I tell him, my whole life, I've been waiting to buy her the roses. My whole life I've been waiting to buy her this dozen long stems. And now I'm not going to buy it for her? Rabbi Akiva turned to the students and said, this is what life is about. It's about letting go and loving and giving. And sure it hurts. But the alternative is to live a lonely, selfish life. He looked at the students and he said, and now I'm not going to buy her the roses? Rabbi Akiva closed his eyes and he began to sing.
Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad.
He never finished the word Echad. God is one. God is unity. God is connection. God is relationship. I turned to my Rebbe and I said to him, Rebbe, that's so unfair. He lived his whole life to be able to say those words and he never actually got to say them at the end. My Rebbe said, no, Leib. Saying the Shema is the exercise for developing Ahava. Rebbe Kiva had pinned the needles on Ahava. He didn't need to say those words anymore. He'd become like a Kodesh Baruch Hu. The angels in heaven cried out, Zu Torah v'zu Schara! This is Torah! And this is its reward! A man at age 40 years old turns his life upside down for Torah, becomes a Baal Tshuva, goes off to yeshiva, slowly builds himself until finally he's the greatest Talmud scholar on the planet. And this is his reward? Zu Torah v'zu Schara? My Rebbe said, no, Leib, you're misreading the last line of the Gemara. That's not how it reads. I said, no, Rebbe, I'm looking at the words. It says, Zu Torah v'zu Schara. This is Torah, this is its reward? No, my Rebbe said, no, that's not how you inflect it, though. The last line of the Gemara reads as follows. The angels in heaven cried out, and they said, Oh, they said, Zu Torah. This is Torah. It's a system for falling in love. Vezu Schara. And this is its reward. If all you want to do is to give, if all you want to do is take care of, if all you want to do is become the quintessential lover, Hashem will give you opportunities. He'll bring you a spouse who you can give to and sacrifice for and take care of and love. He'll bring you children, biological or otherwise, who you can pour your heart into and experience pain with and struggle with. And he'll keep bringing more and more people to you for you to take care of and love. Oh, the angel said, this is Torah and this is its reward. If all you want to be is the lover, God will help you get there. We live in such a crazy world where they're living such upside down lives that the idea of loving, of giving, of sacrificing for somebody else is frightening to us, because the whole society is running off the cliff. When we turn around and start to walk back in the other direction, we feel like we're strange, we're doing something wrong. Is this really psychologically healthy? And of course then, you look at how many people go to see psychologists and psychiatrists, how many people are on Prozac and other antidepressants, what the suicide rates are, what the divorce rates are. You see the misery in the streets, you see the population in the jails. You see the bizarre unhappiness among the wealthiest. And you realize that life is not about me. That's not called life. Life is all about you. Love is when you develop so much Ahava for somebody that all you dream about all day is, when do I get to see her again, and when can I make her happy, and how can I do it for her? And you walk around with your feet 3 feet off the ground because all you want to do is to give and to love and to care. That's what it means to be alive. Not respiratory activity, not a heartbeat. Being a lover, that's what life is about. May it be God's will that every person here tonight merits to dive into the water and to swim like fish and to experience what it's like to have a fantastic marriage and warm relationships with children and with grandchildren, with great-grandchildren, to be part of a community, to have close ties to a Rebbe, to a teacher, to be in a world of connection. May it be God's will that we all be zocha to really, really, really know what love is. Have a good evening. Amen.